claims that law must be colorblind, or that the datum of race is no longer relevant to public policy, must be seen as aspiration rather than as descriptive of reality.
It has been 25 years since Justice Powell first suggested approval of the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of higher education. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today.
Hello and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast. My name is Elise Spenner.
And I'm Hannah Sarah.
And today we are super, super excited to play an episode we recorded with Lisa Stahlberg.
Lisa is an associate professor of sociology of education, which we know is not our traditional guest, at NYU's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. Her research focuses on the politics of race in education, affirmative action in higher education, which we've been talking about, school choice policy, which she's going to explain later, and LGBTQ plus social change. She's the author and co-editor of tons and tons of books. She's amazing. And we are so happy to have her on the podcast today.
We're going to skip our usual intro lesson because we feel like the past three episodes that we've recorded, our kind of overview, our interview with Professor Macer, and our discussion with Professor Ford, tells you everything you need to know for this episode. And Professor Stahlberg is going to do a great job of kind of previewing what school choice looks like, her work that she did in the charter school system, and how schooling looked after Brown versus Board of Education. So let's jump into that episode right now.
Professor Stahlberg, we are so excited that you could join us today. I get to ask my favorite question, which is, what were you like in high school?
Thank you. And it's great to be here. Nice to meet you both. So I've been listening to your podcast, and I think my story kind of matches everybody else's. I was your standard issue nerd, basically. I loved school. I loved doing well in school. I also was a swimmer. I was editor of my yearbook. I was a big sister. That was really important to me. But I always just cared about being a good student. And I thought I had wanted to go to law school at some point. So I kind of considered myself a bit of a law nerd in high school, but then kind of changed paths once I got to college. But yeah, basic standard issue nerd.
Nerds are very welcome on this podcast. So tell us a little bit more about your educational experience from elementary school into higher education and how your personal experience has informed how you think about education now.
So I grew up in Chicago, right on the campus of the University of Chicago, and I went to the school that was associated with the University of Chicago that was started by John Dewey, who you may have heard of, who's a progressive educator, started the school at the end of the 1800s. So it was a very old, elite private school in Chicago that fancied itself progressive in the way that it taught pedagogically. And I think it was generally fairly politically progressive. It was relatively diverse racially, not so much in terms of socioeconomic status, but my family was really liberal. I grew up kind of liberal, Jewish, white, talked a lot about politics around the dinner table. My dad was on the board of the local ACLU when I was in high school. And so we talked about politics and law a lot around the table. And I think that that definitely informed my politics. I considered myself liberal and politically active from when I was pretty young.
I think you definitely just described my entire
adolescent
experience. Very funny. I go to a school that was started in like 1924, and they really love progressive education as the model of teaching and all of that. Like, yep, check, check, check.
Yeah.
But what was your experience like as you moved into higher education?
So I went to Harvard for undergrad, and I consider my high school experience very elite, and I had a lot of privilege in the way that my college advising worked, and I had a lot of test prep, and my dad also attended Harvard. He was the first, I think, so his dad immigrated to the US and kind of typical Eastern European Jewish immigrant story, a lot of social mobility in that generation. So I think he felt pretty out of place at Harvard. He grew up in a small town in Michigan and his parents just wanted him to go to University of Michigan. I think the story was that it cost $70 a semester to go to Michigan at the time. And so they thought, this is a perfectly great education, you should go there. But he decided he wanted to go east. And so I had that advantage going into the admissions process. I was very politically engaged at Harvard. I started college in 1988. So end of the Reagan era, beginning of the first Bush administration, very interesting time. I wrote for and edited a progressive newspaper at Harvard called The Perspective. And I was really engaged in writing and writing politically. I took my first sociology class early enough so that I hadn't declared a major yet. And I just fell in love with sociology. And so became really engaged in trying to figure out how to think about the law, but from a sociological perspective, and just decided that that was what I wanted to do with my life, even though I had always sort of thought that I wanted to become a civil rights lawyer. I could see how that was not going to be the best path for me and that I was going to really love just reading and writing and teaching.
That's really, really awesome. And just like informing that you don't need to know exactly what you want to do when you go to college.
Yeah, definitely. Let yourself fall in love with something that you didn't even know existed before you got there. Always a good thing.
Right. So let's jump back to the immediate aftermath of Brown v. Board, because you've written a lot about how this history of segregation and discrimination informs the school choice movement and everything that we see today with schooling. So what did both primary and secondary school and like higher education look like immediately after Brown?
So yeah, it's interesting thinking about the reach of the Supreme Court and how things happen with the Supreme Court. So the Brown decision came down in the spring of 1954. But there were two decisions actually in Brown. So the first decision in Brown ruled that de jure segregation was illegal. So basically segregation by race that was written into law was no longer constitutional. But it took a while for that to actually be put into practice. So there was another decision in 1955 that gets known as Brown 2, where they basically allowed school districts to move with all deliberate speed, which means really slowly in desegregating. So there was really a very slow and patchwork way of desegregation across the country in K-12 education. And I think that that's really important to keep in mind, that just the decision itself didn't change a lot right away, even though it changed a number of laws across the country. I think there's a lot, if you're interested, I can recommend a lot of good reading here. I've learned a lot from historians and sociologists who have written about this time period. I did not learn a lot in school, really, until I got to graduate school about the sort of history of race and education, including the Brown decision and all of its aftermath. But I think also importantly, the Brown decision didn't really affect higher education right away. So even though the NAACP, which had brought the cases in the that were argued in Brown, they started out trying to affect change in higher education. When they moved to bringing the Brown cases, those cases were about K-12 education, and it wasn't really clear how the Brown decision was going to, or whether it was even going to be relevant to higher ed. So it took a couple of other court decisions for higher ed to finally kind of fall under the rubric of Brown and for the court to rule that it applied in Brown. So really not a lot of change right away. It took a number of years and a lot more court decisions for the sort of de facto, the in fact segregation to be tackled by the Supreme Court. And there was really only a period of maybe until like the early 70s, like 1973, 74, when the court was really actively involved in desegregating schools. And then it really pulled back. So it wasn't very long that the court was sort of actively caring about and involved in school desegregation. And as you know, schools are still incredibly segregated. So Brown did not take care of that by any means.
Yeah, I'm going to jump a little bit. You founded a community-based charter school in Oakland. What prompted you to kind of abandon the ivory tower in favor of working on the ground to provide resources and school choice for the communities around you?
So I kind of did this while I was in the ivory tower, so to speak. I was getting a PhD in sociology at UC Berkeley at the time that the charter school movement was just getting started. And I was working as just a volunteer in an after-school program in West Oakland, California. And through that process, I became friends with a community activist named Marjorie Wilkes, who's still a close friend and who still lives in the Bay Area. And she was really interested in using this new mechanism called charter schooling to try to serve students who are being underserved in the Oakland public schools. This was right around the time that affirmative action was really under attack in California. The University of California system in 1995 had voted to eliminate affirmative action by race and gender. And then the next year in 1996, Proposition 209 passed, and that eliminated affirmative action in the entire state. And so there was this sense that racial progress was moving backwards, and there had been a report in the Oakland public schools that African-American students were really being underserved. And so I was part of a larger group. It was predominantly African-American group that was interested in primarily serving the African-American students in Oakland, who did make up a majority of the district. And we started talking about a mechanism to do that, and charter schools were new and they were possible. And so we worked on founding this community-based charter school called the West Oakland Community School. I never worked at the school directly. I was part of the founding group and I was actively involved in the founding. And then I wrote my dissertation and then my first book on that school and the founding of that school. So I kind of did it while I was in school. I knew I really wanted to be involved in the school as much as possible. And then I also needed to write a dissertation. So I figured I could do both by kind of combining my interests there. And yeah, we can talk more about charter school history if you want, but it was a really interesting time just at the beginning of charter schooling and kind of before the politics had really solidified in the way that they're so contentious now.
I feel like I've only heard what we've descended into when it comes to charter schools, like very intense political sides around whether they're beneficial, and it's so divisive.
Yeah.
So talk me through, what was the idea behind how charter schools could serve as this method of school choice and creating diverse environments for students?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, school choice is something that I definitely had as a kid. Like, I grew up in an upper middle class family. We had the resources to move to a neighborhood where there were good schools, and I consider that a part of school choice. Like, a lot of people do move to an area for its schooling. I also went to private school, so my parents had the resources to be able to fund private school tuition. Those are forms of choice. And so school choice has existed for people with means forever in this country. And it's only really become contentious when it's being opened up to a broader public and people who might not be able to afford to move to an area for good schooling, or might not be able to afford to opt out of the public schools if they're not very good. So initially, charter schools were supported by kind of a broad group of people. And actually, the person who initially had the idea was a union leader called Albert Shanker. He had the idea in the 80s, and this is less known because now you think of unions as being so opposed to charter schools, but he actually came up with a way that he felt that teachers could have more control over schooling and parents could also have more choice. And quickly that changed, in part because there was a large voucher movement at the time. We don't hear as much about that now, but there were people, especially conservatives, who wanted to privatize public education through vouchers, which were publicly funding, basically giving tuition vouchers to parents to pay private school tuition. And so that really was a way to undermine the public education system. And the charter school debate kind of got wrapped up in the voucher debate, I think, at the time. I think I would have been somebody in the 90s who was opposed to charter schools if I hadn't been part of them from the beginning. I'm politically progressive. I care about public education a lot. I support unions. I want there to be equal, accessible education. I would love for schools to be racially and economically integrated. And I know that some of the arguments around charter schooling then and now were that charter schools could further segregation, that they sort of cream the top students or the most involved parents out of the public school system. You know, these are some of the arguments, that they don't necessarily have to take every child, that they're kind of undermining public education. Some of those I think are valid, and some of them now I really don't think are valid. But I learned that from being part of this very small progressive community-based school, and also from studying other forms of school choice that had been around that came out of social movements for racial justice in the 60s and 70s and 80s, that there are a lot of ways to do school choice, and that charter schooling, which is really just a mechanism for giving more choice and more flexibility to parents and to educators, it doesn't have to be progressive and, you know, doing good things pedagogically, but it can be a mechanism for that. So I think it's gotten just really, just like with a lot of school issues that are very contentious, it's gotten very contentious and polarized. And I think it's actually just a lot more complex than that. And I can see that there can be good models.
So you kind of alluded to this just now, but how did your experience working and founding the community-based charter school change or add nuance to your perspective on what roles schools and education should play in their communities?
Something that I've been thinking about as like a theme throughout my work and what I study is the intersection of social movements and schooling. And I think about this with school choice. I think about it with affirmative action. I also study LGBTQ plus social change. And I think this is a part of that as well as thinking about gender and sexuality in schools, that schools are a really important place for identity building. They're a really important place for politics. And they've always, or at least since the Brown decision and probably before, been a really important site for race politics in the US. And so partly my experience with co-founding the school and just thinking about trying to think in a complex way about charter schooling is to really pay attention to the way that these movements for social change get connected to school efforts. And for my dissertation, I went back in history and looked at other efforts for school choice and school building by African-American communities and movements and found that there were a lot of school choice possibilities and movements and efforts, both public and private, that were part of educational self-determination movements by Black communities. And so to me, part of my experience has been about really thinking about the intersection of social change and education. And then also just, I do think that there's sort of a knee-jerk reaction for political progressives to be opposed to things like charter schools. And I am really grateful that my experience has just made that more complicated for me, that I haven't changed my politics. Like, I'm still consider myself very politically progressive. And I also support some forms of school choice that others might not when they hear about them. So yeah, just thinking about the complexity, I think, is always really important.
Right. Thinking about the complexity and also just how many strings there are attached to every decision you make when it comes to schools, like so many people that care about what happens in schools. That's what I've observed so much, is that like every decision that is made in our schools becomes a social and cultural issue too. And you have to be so careful. I don't know. I could never be like a school administrator, anyone that makes decisions about schools, because it's just so much pressure. So I want to talk about school choice and affirmative action and also desegregation initiatives and kind of how they work together, but maybe not totally together, because I find myself thinking about, you know, like busing in the aftermath of Brown v. Board, and that while it was working to bring diversity, could also be seen as like kind of the opposite goal of school choice, and that you didn't really have control over where you were going to school. So how do you think about kind of African-American families wanting a say in where their students attend school, but then also the diversity and inclusion goals of affirmative action and busing and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think with those kinds of desegregation efforts, like busing or early desegregation of colleges, where especially Black and sometimes Latinx students were the first people on campuses and were very racially isolated on their campuses, we can see how some of these efforts really put the burden on students of color, especially Black and Latinx students, to be the early adopters of the change. So for busing, it was often Black students being bused into predominantly white schools. And of course, in early desegregation efforts in higher education, it was often Black students being racially isolated in schools and then facing a lot of backlash for that. And so I think where that connects for me to affirmative action, well, one, I think it's important just to note that there has been this backlash and that these efforts are often the responsibility and the burden often falls to the students who are creating the change and opening up the spaces. And those spaces don't often change for those students. So this is still a conversation we're having in college and graduate school life, that the school culture and the systems have to change so that students feel that they belong on those campuses and in those schools. It's not enough to just open up the doors to those schools and have the schools remain exactly the same. So when we think about affirmative action, we think about bringing sort of a critical mass of students of color to institutions that had been predominantly and historically white, And that's what we saw in the early affirmative action years of the 60s, is that the doors had opened on these college campuses so that there might be a few Black students on these campuses, but there weren't enough to create student groups and to create conversations among those students about how to change the institutions to serve them better. And affirmative action was in part demanded by those students so that there could be a critical mass of those students to really change the institutions to serve them better. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's in part how I see the link, is that affirmative action is not just about bringing a token number of students to campus or to a school. It's really about helping to change the institutions so that those students have a sense of belonging in them and can be really well served by the institution.
I think kind of what I'm grasping is like this core idea, whether you're trying to start a charter school that focuses on school choice or bringing affirmative action to higher education, is making a place where underrepresented minorities feel like they belong. It's not just like, we're just bringing you here so that we can say we are a diverse school, but that actually you're creating an environment that students want to come to. And then that's kind of combining the goals of school choice and affirmative action. I don't know if I captured that correctly.
Yeah, I'd have to think about the school choice connection also, because I think it's different in higher education where everybody has school choice, but I think that's right, in that really the kind of larger conversation is about how to change school institutions so that they can serve everybody well. And I think that that also means having people in decision-making positions as well. So when we look back to the social movements of the 60s on college campuses, the same groups that were asking for affirmative action were also asking for the hiring of administrators of color and people to represent students and communities of color in decision-making roles at the universities, so that there could be a conversation where a diverse group of people could be around the table about how to make the schools more inclusive. And so the culture actually changes and you can't really have success of a diverse group of students if the institutions are not willing to change.
Yeah. So recently we've seen parents adopt the school choice anthem in this effort to end diversity initiatives and kind of return to a merit-based system of admission, especially at the public high school level. Notably, there's Lowell High School, which has faced heavy, heavy backlash for jumping back and forth between a merit and lottery-based admission system.
Yeah.
And so we kind of had two questions for you. The first one is, what is your response to these efforts? And the second one is, what do these conflict zones tell you about how our culture and society reacts to diversity efforts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing they just indicate to me is that there just aren't enough high quality public schools. So there are these selective high schools like Lowell, and New York City has a number of them too, and cities around the country that serve a lot of students have these schools that have been selective. And I think that they are an indication that there aren't public school options to serve everybody well. And so that's one thing, is just we need to have the public and political will in this country to create high quality schools. And I don't think we have that. I don't even think we value education very much in this country. I don't think we value teaching very much. I don't think we really set up the public systems to have lots of Lowells, you know, so we wouldn't have this scramble for these very few spaces in one very selective school. I also think that it indicates something, this conversation around merit. Like, I think that this is a very American conversation, that there is this kind of mythology of the American dream, that if you work hard, you can succeed in the US. And I think that there's that idea is sort of attached to this like race and class neutral idea that anybody can do this. But what we know is that merit is not race or class neutral. It's not language neutral. It's not gender neutral. And so I think that this conversation around Lowell, or we can talk about selective college admissions too, really gets to what merit means and what people attached to it. And I think in an environment where there's scarcity, like where there isn't enough good public schooling, or where college admissions is so hyper selective right now, people are so worried about fairness. And I think that gets attached to this conversation around merit, which then becomes around test scores. And we know that there are so many problematic things and so many things related to power and privilege built into things like the definition of merit, or to standardized testing, or to grades. And so there's so much politics and power built into something that gets framed as neutral, like a test score. And so this isn't completely answering your question, but I think these debates that are really, I understand why parents on all sides feel that the stakes are really high in these debates or in their children's lives and these school decisions. But I also think that what it speaks to is a sort of broader problem with American education and then a broader problem with the American dream narrative that kind of frames merit as neutral. And if you're interested, there's a really interesting book by Nicholas Lehman called The Big Test, which is about standardized testing and how problematic it's been throughout its history that I've learned a lot from and kind of trying to understand this, how merit has been framed over the course of at least the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century.
I wanted to ask you about higher education and diversity. So we talked to Professor Jonathan Mesa recently, and he did this empirical study of the diversity rationale and how it plays out in schools. How would you say you've firsthand observed the benefits of diversity in higher education as a student, as a professor, however you want to take that?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. I think it's this focus on diversity. We often think of it as being connected to the Bakke decision in 1978 that allowed some consideration of race in higher education and then more broadly in education admissions decisions. And it actually goes back a lot farther than that. So college administrators were really interested in broad diversity way before the Bakke decision. And so I just wanted to say that it's not as new as we think it is, that there's been a focus on making sure that college campuses reflect the US population and that they're sort of bringing together a student body that could come into classrooms and clash in their opinions and bring their broad experiences to their learning. And so it's not new for me to say that I think diversity is central to the way that we learn in higher education, but I do think it is. I think classrooms are always better if people can bring a wide range of experiences and perspectives to them. And I honestly just can't imagine teaching in a place or having learned in a place that wasn't diverse in many ways. I think it's a big divide in our country right now. I think that it's a value of people like me who it's just so built into my value system that I feel like my life is enriched if I can learn something from somebody that I didn't know before and that I can learn about their experiences and I can change my views based on something that I learned that I didn't know before because I didn't have that life experience. At the same time, I think that the way I just framed it has been a way that colleges have framed it as sort of an amenity for white students for a long time. Like, our school is so diverse, come here and you will learn from people who are different from you. And that's been considered an amenity for the majority for a long time. So I would say again, like, I think the important thing is that the schools that are valuing diversity and making their decisions so that they do bring in diverse classes of students, that they are taking into consideration that that can't be in a tokenistic way and that the institutions have to change so that those students don't feel like they're just there to be a learning tool for the majority or that they're just there as a token and that their experiences as an outsider or as marginalized. That has been a really big problem in both secondary and in higher education. And so I think that when we think about diversity and how important it is and how central it is to learning, we also have to think about changing the institutions so that students who are quote unquote, you know, diverse or, you know, bringing that diversity to campus also feel that they are belonging to those institutions and that those institutions are changing to serve them well.
Yeah, that's a great point that you make about how diversity in the classroom is a huge benefit to white students, but can also tokenize students of color. I remember in my sophomore year of high school, I took a Race in America class, and that was one of the most diverse classes at my school because obviously it's called Race in America. I just drew in a large number of people, and we would do discussions where sometimes it would be just the white students and the students of color talking. Sometimes it would be we'd split up into gender and race groups, and sometimes we'd all be together and it would vary how we do groups because our teacher really wanted to emphasize how white students get to gain a lot from students of color, and also students of color like deserve their own space to learn and think and not be helping white students understand things, which I thought was really cool. And I feel like maybe you've already answered this, but in our traditional debates about affirmative action, what do you think that most people don't understand about the goal of achieving diversity in higher education?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping that I can pull this back a little bit to a definition, because I think it's important and just the history. So I'm working on a book project right now with a really good friend of mine from graduate school, Anthony Chen, who's a professor of sociology at Northwestern. And we've been working on it for a while. It's on the history and political development of affirmative action in higher education. And so part of what I know about the history of diversity comes from that study. And so I think one of the things that people don't know is that these conversations around diversity and around affirmative action have been around for a long time. And also that affirmative action right now is, it can mean placing a thumb on the scale where race is taken into consideration in an affirmative way, but it is a small thumb. So it is not a, it's, you know, college admissions now are very holistic. They are that way by law. You know, the Supreme Court has said it can't be a mechanistic admissions process. Race can be considered in a small way through a holistic process. And so when people think about affirmative action, often I think they think that there's this like huge advantage being given to underrepresented students of color by virtue of their racial background. And that's just not true. And also, I think it's important to know that these policies have been around a long time, and they were not very radical, and they weren't proposed by very radical people. So affirmative action has been around on college campuses since the early to mid 60s. That was not a particularly radical time in higher education or in the country. Yeah, the civil rights movement was not particularly radical then. And it was really a result of administrators in higher ed recognizing that higher education had a role to play in social change and that they could make a difference by shifting their admissions practices and by really paying attention to who they were training to be leaders in the US and in the world. So I guess my part of my takeaway would be these policies have been around a long time, and they're not the kind of large benefit to students of color many people on the anti side would have us believe. And also that they are really necessary for, you know, there have been a number of studies that have looked at what the alternatives to race conscious affirmative action would be. So like if we went to a class conscious form of affirmative action or some other kind of, you know, placing a thumb on the scale in college admissions, and nothing else seems to really work to achieve the kind of racial diversity that many people want and benefit from in higher education.
And honestly, I feel like moving to, and I think why, I think I know schools already pay attention to class and like all of that, but it feels like that would just be really disingenuous. Like we're just using class as a way to get at racial diversity, but so why don't we just like think about race? But I feel like that's kind of we've talked to a lot of people obviously about affirmative action, and this whole idea that like schools aren't going to stop trying to achieve diversity. It's just how explicit and overt they are about doing it, because the Supreme Court might, you know, say you can't do it. Like you can't say students will get in because they're a certain race. You have to say holistic, but now you can't even say like you're considering race. And I feel like that's interesting. Is that like, you know, nothing's going to change about what schools are doing really.
And I think it's interesting, because I think the reason why that's true is because students want that diversity. Like it's an important part of what it means to go to an elite educational institution now, is that you're not just going with people that just look like you and have had the same life experience as you. So it's actually a selling point for schools. So partly why they wouldn't change that is because they know that it would hurt them if they suddenly became a lot less diverse, I think.
So kind of last question, I happened to the fact that you are like a sociology professor. So why are people so vehemently opposed to affirmative action? Not just legally, obviously they are, like a lot of people are legally, but like culturally and sociologically, like how do we talk to people about affirmative action? And also talk to them about like how affirmative action isn't just like balancing the playing field or like making things unfair for their student, but actually something like they should want to make their, like just for all the reasons we've talked about today.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think I've been thinking a lot about just higher ed now because of, you know, selective college admissions right now is So there's just so much that's wrong with it. And there's such a feeling that there's such scarcity in elite college admissions and selection. So I think people are anxious about getting into the colleges that they've been working towards a good bit of their lives. And so I think that scarcity creates a sense of just worry about what is fair. I also think, though, what's one of the things that's happening with college admissions is we're rethinking what merit means. So the fact that schools have been test optional, or, you know, in the case of the UC system, you know, test free for the past couple of years, that's going to really open up this conversation around what standardized tests do in this process and how they really, you know, do they really reflect merit, and do they really reflect something that's going to be important to measure for college admissions and for the success of college students. So I think that that's like something that's up for grabs in college admissions right now, is just the role of standardized testing. And so that, I think, will be a really interesting part of the conversation around affirmative action and what the criteria are for college admissions. And I think we can't discount the Republican, conservative, Trump contribution to all of this, that I do think that support for affirmative action has been declining in recent years. I was looking for some good news on this and I couldn't really find it, that it really does seem that most people now, you know, oppose using race as a factor in college admissions in a way that I don't think was true when we first were paying attention to this in the 90s. And even though the anti-affirmative action movement has been around for a long time, I do think that this politics of white grievance and, you know, the replacement theory and all of those sort of ways of framing the world from the political right now have been part of why there is such a backlash to affirmative action and why we have the makeup of the Supreme Court we have right now, which is likely to take away affirmative action this coming summer. So I think that the way to frame it as something to support for people is partly to have that conversation around what merit means and the role of standardized testing in college admissions and in our lives in general, you know, for high school and college. And then I think really tapping into what it is that people want out of college, and that if people do, you know, if students are looking for an experience where they're learning from people that are not like them, and they're going to have experiences and have conversations that are going to open up their worldview, then right now we still need affirmative action. And, you know, we still have a lot of structural racism in this country. And, you know, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, when she wrote her opinion in 2003, said that the way to measure whether we won't, you know, hopefully we won't need affirmative action in 25 years. And we're not at that place yet. We still do have a huge amount of structural racism that means we have unequal secondary schooling, and we have a lot of barriers to entry and to success for underrepresented students of color. And so therefore, we're not yet at the place where we can eliminate this tool for increasing diversity on college campuses.
Professor Stahlberg, thank you so much. This has been so great, and I'm so happy we can have you on today.
It's been great talking with you and meeting you both. Thank you.
We were so lucky that Professor Stahlberg joined us on the podcast. She is an expert in everything to do with sociology, education, the politics, and the law of school choice and race-conscious admissions policies. And we are just so happy that she came on our podcast to talk with us. And we hope you enjoyed the episode as well.
In the near future, we're super excited because Professor Richard Sander of UCLA Law School will be joining us on the podcast. But for now, you can leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for any more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, you can check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Literally everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com. We can't wait to see you next time.